we have these individuals, and I'm going to sort of speed through things because I think we need to bring to conclusion what we learn from these lives. Saint Sophronius was born in Damascus. He was an Arab. And when he came, he was well educated. He taught rhetoric and philosophy. And an acquaintance of Saint Basil, in particular Libanus, received him. And fleeing the oppression of the Persians that started in 614, in the company of John Moschus, he finally returned to Jerusalem after the Persians left, and was elevated because of the two patriarchs in very quick sequence passed. He then was elected Patriarch of Jerusalem, and he reposed in 638. While he was with John Moschus, they visited many monasteries, learning what they could from all of those they visited. And so we'll take a look at some of the places. He came to Jerusalem, but when he arrived, he visited all the monasteries he could. And then returning to Jerusalem, he found, he says, by chance, the monastery of Theodosius, and he spent some time there. But then, when the Persians threatened, he went to Egypt, Alexandria in particular. And Mother Nectaria, who writes a lot, I found an article really, really great about Saint Sophronius. She has him going overland, but he could have gone by boat. In any case, she sees him spending time at the monastery of Saint Theodosius. And on his way, if he took the land route, he would have gone through Wadi Faran in Sinai, through which it is traditionally understood the Israelites came out of Egypt through that wadi, and also the monastery of Saint Anthony in Egypt, which would have been on the way to ultimately Alexandria and the ruins of the monastery of Saint Minas, just north of Skytus on the east side of the Nile Delta. But then he came back after the Persians retreated, and he went to Jerusalem and was elected patriarch in 634. He not only was there as patriarch, but during that time he recorded something that every year we read, and that's the life of Saint Mary of Egypt that Father Zosimus had passed on to his fellow monastics, and ultimately Saint Sophronius wrote it down so that we could have it. But not only that, Troparion, he wrote hundreds of these that are now a part of our Lenten triodion. And the fact that his patriarchate ended with making a treaty with Caliph Ibn al-Kafar for the turning over of the city and the keys to the Church of the whole, of the Resurrection was heartbreaking for him. But when he came in, the Caliph, thinking that he shouldn't be too haughtily attired, wore rags. And Saint Sophronius made him go and change into attire that is befitting his office as a general coming into a place that is to be respected. And the fact that he personally took the Caliph to every sacred spot that he was asking him to protect and not destroy. There was a partial observance of that agreement. And he went out of the city to the Mount of Olives, where the Caliph was waiting for him to finalize this agreement, which has essentially been in effect since then to this day, in that the same Arab family originally from Medina opens and closes the doors with keys that were given to him from the Caliph that Saint Sophronius had given to him. But this is a psychiatrist's view of our world today. The kind of world that Saint Saba, Saint Theodosius knew, but slightly different. Theodore Isaac Rubin said, "Our society is a glory-seeking, pride-oriented, dynamic system which influences each family to influence each newborn child to predicate his or her self-acceptance on where he or she lands on the self-glorification hierarchy. Simply put, it means that we accept ourselves almost exclusively in terms of achievement and success as it's measured by money, prestige, power, sexual attractiveness, or youth." Now, that is a psychiatric analysis of the world we live in. But Jesus said, "I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. I'm the good shepherd." And he, Jesus, said to them, "Come away by yourselves to a lonely place and rest a while." And this brings us to the whole issue of silence. If we embrace silence, it means we're listening. If we impose silence, or someone imposes silence on us, it's not exactly tyranny. But it's censoring. And this I wanted to share with you in closing. If we embrace the silence and listen for God's voice, there are treasures not only that have been left to us by the monastics who have spent years there, but we are choosing to follow these saints for a while in our reading so that we can hear what they heard in silence. And you can hear things you've never heard before if you will come away by yourself with him into a desert place. If you read these saints, you'll get to know them. Most of our relationships that are very close have been forged and have been given birth in situations that are difficult. And we've walked through our friends or our family through some of those things. But whether you're leaving on a Lenten sojourn from St. George's in the Wadi Kilt outside of Jericho, looking for a silent place, you may choose to follow St. Euthemius or St. Sabas, or you may choose to follow St. Sophronius or Father Zosimus for 40 days, or you may choose to follow St. Mary for 48 years in a desert and lonely place. And remember, she spent 17 years in a way of life that she wanted to forget, and it took her 17 years to forget it. It isn't something that just happens like that. But above all, follow Christ to a lonely place with him. And find rest for your soul and recapture the conversation that was lost in paradise. Don't take lightly the silence that they entered into, because it's there you can hear, like Elijah, the still small voice that wasn't in the fire, the earthquake. It was in the stillness that followed. that. Jesus stood up and proclaimed, "If anyone thirsts, let him come to me," because in the desert you need water, right? "Come to me and drink. He who believes in me, as the scripture has said, out of his innermost being shall flow rivers of living water." Mein Heim. And in the rabbinic Jewish understanding of that phrase, living water, it's the most purifying water there is. Spring water, not green water. And this he said about the Spirit, which those who believed in him were to receive. And water comes in its season down through the Wadi gullies after a rain. But also there's some ways in which water finds its way to flow all year round. And there's living spring water that comes from between the layers of the rock. And you can drink the water. But don't be afraid of silence. These ibex live in a world of silence. And this little guy, I saw him fall off a cliff and get back up and find his way all up again. So thank you for coming. And a rock back.
Dale, how many of those monasteries are still functioning? That were all those that you were talking about?
In the late 1800s, the Jerusalem Patriarchate restored and revived, I think, at least a half a dozen of them. And you could see, like, the monastery of St. Euthemius in Jerusalem and Bethlehem, it's in good shape. Mar Saba, St. George's, Orthodox monks are returning to Hariton in the outside of Jerusalem in the Wadi Faran. And there are some monastics. Some of them, one of them, a nun, you know, what's the resident of one of the advisors, Papadopoulos?
George
Papadopoulos. His sister is a monastic. And she and a couple of other nuns would go into the West Bank, where there was no jurisdiction taking care of them, and they would lock themselves in until there was somebody who would come and take responsibility, put somebody resident there so they wouldn't be confiscated or misused. With a lot of the churches, there's some monastic presence. So I don't know. I know archaeologists count how many they can identify, whether they're ruins or not, but I don't know that there's anybody who is taking responsibility to keep them alive if they are functioning.